Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 54. Is this Orwellian or what? Eric Arthur Blair, known by his pen name George Orwell, was an English novelist and journalist. His work is marked by clarity, awareness of social injustice, opposition to totalitarianism, and commitment to democratic socialism. He was born in 1903 and passed away in 1950. Considered perhaps the 20th century's best chronicler of English culture, Orwell wrote literary criticism, poetry, fiction, and polemical journalism. He's best known for the dystopian novel 1984 and the allegorical novella Animal Farm, which together have sold more copies than any two books by any other 20th century author. Times ranked him second on a list of the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Orwell's work continues to influence popular and political culture, and the term Orwellian, descriptive of totalitarian or authoritarian social practices, has entered the language together with several of his neologisms, including Cold War, Big Brother, Thought Police, Doublethink, and Thought Crime. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Over the years, reading alternative news sites, progressive news sites, whatever you want to call them, without knowing the statistics, I would say that the two most referenced works of fiction are, now this is in sort of comparison to what's going on in the news in the world, the two that I've noticed are The Emperor's New Clothes, which is a story by Hans Christian Andersen. Most are familiar with it. Wikipedia says, about two weavers who promise an emperor a new suit of clothes that is invisible to those unfit for their positions, stupid or incompetent. When the emperor parades before his subjects in his new clothes, a child cries out, but he isn't wearing anything at all. So it's often referred to when people are in the news, in the world, showing their true colors, so to speak. And the other most referenced is George Orwell, or Orwellian, or various phrases from his work. mostly 1984. Now, I've seen the movie at least a couple times. I'm not even sure if I read the book. I think if I did, it was way, way back. Just gonna touch briefly on that today because more of what the show's about is a piece of writing that a friend sent to me a while back by George Orwell called Why I Write, written in 1946, and it is a fascinating take on writing in general and also how it connects to what's how you be a writer in the world and how you deal with the sort of sometimes dreaded political word. One of the first shows done on Between the Lines was the so-called political poem. As a poet, I occasionally get comments, like, oh, he writes a lot of political poems, as if it's some kind of stigma, whereas, as you'll see from Orwell's piece, it is a necessity. So, obviously, it depends on your bent as an artist, but Orwell makes quite the case for writing like that. Just to give some brief references to how today's world and news is reminiscent of what Orwell was writing about. Well, of course, especially more recently with all the NSA and surveillance, is the whole Big Brother is watching kind of theme. Statements in 1984 like peace is war. Obama's winning the Nobel Peace Prize while being involved in, I don't know how many, I've lost track of how many wars going on. There was a guy wearing an Occupy Everywhere t-shirt who was arrested. This was ironically on July 4th this year. The alternate article posted at Alternet reported police had probable cause to arrest a Marine Corps veteran in the Supreme Court building for wearing a jacket that said Occupy Everywhere, a federal judge ruled. Fitzgerald Scott, another amusing thing there. Fitzgerald Scott, a Marine Corps veteran, entered the Supreme Court building on January 20th, 2012, wearing a jacket painted with the words Occupy Everywhere. The Occupy movement had scheduled that day for an organized protest outside the courthouse. Now, the irony of him getting in trouble for wearing an Occupy Everywhere shirt inside a courtroom that is supposed to allow free speech. I don't know if the founding fathers, had anything about free t-shirt speech. But in any case, when I read that article, I thought, well, you have the U.S. Empire with nearly 1,000 army bases throughout the world. So basically, their motto is Occupy Everywhere. But somebody who comes in with their own agenda with the t-shirt Occupy Everywhere gets into trouble. So that is what we would say. Is that Orwellian or what? Some of the phrases made famous from 1984 are double think and newspeak. And these are from Wikipedia. Doublethink is the act of ordinary people of simultaneously accepting two mutually contradictory beliefs as correct, often in distinct social contexts. Doublethink is related to, but differs from, hypocrisy and neutrality. Also somewhat related, yet almost the opposite, is cognitive dissonance, where contradictory beliefs cause conflict in one's mind. Doublethink is notable due to a lack of cognitive dissonance. Thus, the person is completely unaware of any conflict or contradiction. So that's a whole show on doublethink right there. But you can ponder that in your you can think about that in your spare time. Newspeak is the fictional language in the novel 1984, written by George Orwell. It is a reduced language created by the totalitarian state as a tool to limit free thought and concepts that pose a threat to the regime, such as freedom, self-expression, individuality, peace, etc. Any form of thought alternative to the party's construct is classified as thought crime. Again, a whole topic worthy of discussion. But that's some of the angles come at this kind of sideways, reading George Orwell's piece, Why I write. From a very early age, perhaps the age of 5 or 6, I knew that when I grew up I should be a writer. Between the ages of about 17 and 24, I tried to abandon this idea, but I did so with the consciousness that I was outraging my true nature and that sooner or later I should have to settle down and write books. I was the middle child of 3, but there was a gap of 5 years on either side. And I barely saw my father before I was 8. For this and other reasons, I was somewhat lonely, and I soon developed disagreeable mannerisms which made me unpopular throughout my school days. I had the lonely child's habit of making up stories and holding conversations with imaginary persons, and I think from the very start my literary ambitions were mixed up with the feeling of being isolated and undervalued. I knew that I had a facility with words and a power of facing unpleasant facts, and I felt that this created a sort of private world in which I could get my own back for my failure in everyday life. Nevertheless, the volume of serious, i.e. seriously intended writing, which I produced all through my childhood and boyhood would not amount to half a dozen pages. I wrote my first poem at the age of 4 or 5, my mother taking it down to dictation. I cannot remember anything about it except that it was about a tiger and the tiger had chair-like teeth. A good enough phrase, but I fancy the poem was a plagiarism of Blake's Tiger, Tiger. At 11, when the war of 1914-18 broke out, I wrote a patriotic poem which was printed in the local newspaper, as was another 2 years later on the death of Kitchener. Time to time, when I was a bit older, I wrote bad and usually unfinished semi-quote nature poems. In the Georgian style. I also attempted to a short story, which was a ghastly failure. That was the total of the would-be serious work that I actually set down on paper during all those years. However, throughout this time I did in a sense engage in literary activities. To begin with, there was the made-to-order stuff, which I produced quickly, easily, and without much pleasure to myself. Apart from schoolwork, I wrote vers d'occasion, semi-comic poems which I could turn out at what now seems to me astonishing speed. At 14, I wrote a whole rhyming play in imitation of Aristophanes in about a week, and helped to edit a school magazine, both printed and in manuscript. These magazines were the most pitiful burlesque stuff that you can imagine, and I took far less trouble with them than I now would with the cheapest journalism. But side by side with all this, for 15 years or more, I was carrying out a literary exercise of a quite different kind. This was the making up of a continuous story about myself, a sort of diary existing only in the mind. I believe this is a common habit of children in adolescence. As a very small child, I used to imagine that I was, say, Robin Hood, and picture myself as the hero of thrilling adventures, but quite soon my story ceased to be narcissistic in a crude way and became more and more a mere description of what I was doing and the things I saw. For minutes at a time, this kind of thing would be running through my head. He pushed the door open and entered the room. A yellow beam of sunlight filtering through the muslin curtains slanted on to the table where a matchbox half open lay beside the inkpot. With his right hand in his pocket, he moved across to the window. Down in the street, a tortoiseshell cat was chasing a dead leaf, etc., etc. This habit continued until I was about 25, right through my non-literary years. Although I had to search and did search for the right words, I seemed to be making this descriptive effort almost against my will, under a kind of compulsion from the outside. The story must, I suppose, have reflected the styles of the various writers I admired at different ages, but so far as I remember, it always had the same meticulous descriptive quality. When I was about 16, I suddenly discovered the joy of mere words, i.e. the sounds and associations of words. The lines from Paradise Lost, "So he, with difficulty and labor hard, moved on with difficulty and labor he," which do not now seem to me so very wonderful, sent shivers down my backbone, and the spelling he, H-E-E, for he, H-E, was an added pleasure. As for the need to describe things, I knew all about it already, so it is clear what kind of books I wanted to write, in so far as I could be said to want to write books at that time. I wanted to write enormous, naturalistic novels with unhappy endings full of detailed descriptions and arresting similes and also full of purple passages in which words were used partly for the sake of their own sound. And in fact, my first completed novel, Burmese Days, which I wrote when I was 30, but projected much earlier, is rather that kind of book. I give all this background information because I do not think one can assess a writer's motives without knowing something of his early development. His subject matter will be determined by the age he lives in. At least this is true in tumultuous revolutionary ages like our own. But before he ever begins to write, he will have acquired an emotional attitude from which he will never completely escape. It is his job, no doubt, to discipline his temperament and avoid getting stuck at some immature stage in some perverse mood. But if he escapes from his early influences altogether, he will have killed his impulse to write. Putting aside the need to earn a living, I think there are four great motives for writing, at any rate for writing prose. They exist in different degrees in every writer, and in any one writer the proportions will vary from time to time, according to the atmosphere in which he is living. They are. And now he's going to give the four great motives. Now reading these, it really forced me as a writer, as a human being, to honestly look at and remember some of the reasons why, how I got started, how continuing. So I think this piece is an excellent challenge to really explore your own writing and be honest with yourself. Number one, sheer egoism. Desire to seem clever, to be talked about, to be remembered after death, to get your own back on the grown-ups who snubbed you in childhood, etc., etc. It is humbug to pretend this is not a motive and a strong one. Writers share this characteristic with scientists, artists, politicians, lawyers, soldiers, successful businessmen, in short, with the whole top crust of humanity. The great mass of human beings are not acutely selfish. After the age of about 30, they almost abandon the sense of being individuals at all and live chiefly for others or are simply smothered under drudgery. But there is also the minority of gifted, willful people who are determined to live their own lives to the end. And writers belong in this class. Serious writers, I should say, are on the whole more vain and self-centered than journalists, though less interested in money. And one of the things about that is it made me look at sort of the place where what he calls sheer egoism merges with a higher calling. Kind of, that desire to write a great piece of work, to serve humanity, to perhaps be remembered, to help people. So again, looking at these things, you can find your own ways to agree or disagree or come up with your own categories. Number two, aesthetic enthusiasm. Perception of beauty in the external world or, on the other hand, in words and their right arrangement. Pleasure in the impact of one sound on another, in the firmness of good prose or the rhythm of a good story. Desire to share an experience which one feels is valuable and ought not to be missed. The aesthetic motive is very feeble in a lot of writers, but even a pamphleteer or writer of textbooks will have pet words and phrases which appeal to him for non-utilitarian reasons. Or he may feel strongly about typography, width of margins, etc. Above the level of a railway guide, no book is quite free from aesthetic considerations. This reminded of a piece by Annie Dillard a long time ago I read, where she was describing a painter, and some question or some answer that the painter gave was of loving paint. So whatever your craft, as much as there's it can be a higher, loftier goal, there's a loving the actual, the craft itself, the tools. So, as a writer, perhaps you love a particular pen, but more along the aesthetic lines is the toolbox, the words and the phrases. Actually, your relationship with those is kind of the bread and butter building blocks of the writing. Number three. Historical impulse, desire to see things as they are, to find out true facts, and store them up for the use of posterity. That's it on number three, so we'll repeat that. Historical impulse, desire to see things as they are, to find out true facts, and store them up for the use of posterity. Number four, political purpose. And he has the word political in the single quotes, using the word political in the widest possible sense. Desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society they should strive for. Once again, no book is genuinely free from political bias. The opinion that art should have nothing to do with politics is itself a political attitude. It can be seen how these various impulses must war against one another and how they must fluctuate from person to person and from time to time. By nature, taking your nature to be the state you have attained when you are first adult, I am a person in whom the first three motives would outweigh the fourth. In a peaceful age, I might have written ornate or merely descriptive books and might have remained almost unaware of my political loyalties. As it is, I have been forced into becoming a sort of pamphleteer. First, I spent 5 years in an unsuitable profession, the Indian Imperial Police in Burma, and then I underwent poverty and the sense of failure. This increased my natural hatred of authority and made me, for the first time, fully aware of the existence of the working classes, and the job in Burma had given me some understanding of the nature of imperialism, but these experiences were not enough to give me an accurate political orientation. Then came Hitler, the Spanish Civil War, etc. By the end of 1935, I had still failed to reach a firm decision. I remember a little poem that I had wrote at that date expressing my dilemma. A happy vicar I might have been 200 years ago to preach upon eternal doom and watch my walnuts grow. But born, alas, in an evil time, I missed that pleasant haven, for the hair has grown on my upper lip and the clergy are all clean-shaven. And later still, the times were good, we were so easy to please, we rocked our troubled thoughts to sleep on the bosoms of the trees. All ignorant, we dared to own the joys we now dissemble. The green finch on the apple bough could make my enemies tremble. But girls' bellies and apricots, roach in a shaded stream, horses, ducks in flight at dawn, all these are dream. It is forbidden to dream again. We maim our joys or hide them. Horses are made of chromium steel, and little fat men shall ride them. I am the worm who never turned the eunuch without a harem. Between the priest and the commissar, I walk like Eugene Aram. And the commissar is telling my fortune while the radio plays. But the priest has promised an Austin 7, for Dougie always pays. I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls and woke to find it true. I wasn't born for an age like this. Was Smith? Was Jones? Were you? Spanish War and other events in 1936-37 turned the scale, and thereafter I knew where I stood. Every line of serious work that I have written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against, in italics, against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism as I understand it. It seems to me nonsense in a period like our own to think that one can avoid writing of such subjects. Everyone writes of them in one guise or another. It is simply a question of which side one takes and what approach one follows. And the more one is conscious of one's political bias, the more chance one has of acting politically without sacrificing one's aesthetic and intellectual integrity. What I have most wanted to do throughout the past 10 years is to make political writing into an art. My starting point is always a feeling of partisanship, a sense of injustice. When I sit down to write a book, I do not say to myself, I am going to produce a work of art. I write it because there is some lie that I want to expose, some fact to which I want to draw attention, and my initial concern is to get a hearing. But I could not do the work of writing a book or even a long magazine article if it were not also an aesthetic experience. Anyone who cares to examine my work will see that even when it is downright propaganda, it contains much that a full-time politician would consider irrelevant. I am not able and do not want completely to abandon the worldview that I acquired in childhood. So long as I remain alive and well, I shall continue to feel strongly about prose style, to love the surface of the earth, and to take a pleasure in solid objects and scraps of useless information. It is no use trying to suppress that side of myself. The job is to reconcile my ingrained likes and dislikes with the essentially public, non-individual activities that this age forces on all of us. It is not easy. It raises problems of construction and of language, and it raises in a new way the problem of truthfulness. Let me give just one example of the cruder kind of difficulty that arises. My book about the Spanish Civil War, Homage to Catalonia, is of course a frankly political book, but in the main it is written with a certain detachment and regard for form. I did try very hard in it to tell the whole truth without violating my literary instincts. but among other things it contains a long chapter full of newspaper quotations and the like, defending the Trotskyists who were accused of plotting with Franco. Clearly such a chapter, which after a year or two would lose its interest for any ordinary reader, must ruin the book. A critic whom I respect read me a lecture about it. "Why did you put in all that stuff?" he said. "You've turned what might have been a good book into journalism." What he said was true, but I could not have done otherwise. I happened to know what very few people in England had been allowed to know, that innocent men were being falsely accused. If I had not been angry about that, I should never have written the book. In one form or another, this problem comes up again. The problem of language is subtler and would take too long to discuss. I will only say that of late years I have tried to write less picturesquely and more exactly. In any case, I find that by the time you have perfected any style of writing, you have always outgrown it. Animal Farm was the first book in which I tried, with full consciousness of what I was doing, to fuse political purpose and artistic purpose into one whole. I have not written a novel for 7 years, but I hope to write another fairly soon. It is bound to be a failure. Every book is a failure, but I do know with some clarity what kind of book I want to write. Looking back through the last page or two, I see that I have made it appear as though my motives in writing were wholly public-spirited. I do not want to leave that as the final impression. All writers are vain, selfish, and lazy, and at the very bottom of their motives there lies a mystery. Writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle, like a long bout of some painful illness. One would never undertake such a thing if one were not driven on by some demon whom one can neither resist nor understand. For all one knows, that demon is simply the same instinct that makes a baby squall for attention. And yet it is also true that one can write nothing readable unless one constantly struggles to efface one's own personality. Good prose is like a window pane. I cannot say with certainty which of my motives are the strongest, but I know which of them deserve to be followed, and looking back through my work, I see that it is invariably where I lacked a political purpose that I wrote lifeless books and was betrayed into purple passages, sentences without meaning, decorative adjectives, and humbug generally. And that's George Orwell's Why I Write. He kind of cuts back on the sheer egoism in his statement there. One can write nothing readable unless one constantly struggles to efface one's own personality. So again, that egoism bit is perhaps best looked at as a double-edged sword. Interesting, just realized that piece was 1946, and his novel 1984 was published in 1949. So that's an interesting literary trivia right there. I'm gonna wrap up the literary portion by reading a poem, and this ties in with what he mentions, driven by some demon, or however you want to look at that. I think daemon, the way that's spelled or pronounced, is more of a spirit form, not in a negative sense, whom one can neither resist nor understand. Now, this poem, just perhaps power of suggestion, just started happening to me the other day outside the laundromat. Saw a bunch of sparrows hopping around and circling around a chunk of bread, and along with just marveling at the way they were doing it and the beauty of it, the phrase "my political party is" jumped into my head. And so this poem came out of it, and this is one of my ways as a writer of applying the Orwellian sense of politics in literature. And I'm reading this poem partly to show that it's, you know, try to get past the stereotypes of what you think, quote, political means. There's many ways to go about saying what you want to say. It could be serious, it could be funny, it could be sarcastic, it could be satire, it could be, you know, super dramatic, whatever the choices. Personally tend to use humor mixed in with the serious as a way to handle the situation. So this poem is called "My Political Party Is..." dot dot dot, with an ellipsis at the end there. "My political party is..." a small flock of sparrows gathering around a chunk of a roll with sesame seeds. In the laundromat parking lot across the street from the mosque in Judeo-Christian Punjabi Latino et al. Suburbia, under patchy gray skies in July when school is out and people are on vacation and the society is closer to enlightened recreational anarchy than at any other time of the year. My political party is another beer with a re-pub lickin', a cheese sandwich with a Democ rat, a hike through a northwest forest with a member of the Green Party, doing whatever I want to do without harming the Libertarian Party, a buffet with the rent is too damn high party because businesses have gone out because the rent is too damn high. People have gone out into cars and onto the streets because the rent is too damn high. But banks are us, that's U.S., banks are U.S., are too damn greedy because their feet are disconnected from the very earth they bleed, because their souls are disconnected from their calloused feet. My political party is to party like it's 1999. My political party is Moses parting the Red Sea. My political party is the party of the first part really caring about the party of the second part. My political party seeks to abolish all political parties that do not supply valet parking, free beverages and snacks, clean water and real food, free energy to heat the clean water and real food, and a quiet place to heart think about what's next after all the partying. All right, thank you so much for listening, and look up George Orwell, watch some movies, read the books. Very wonderful writer and amazingly prescient, prophetic, whatever you want to call it, about our times. Help us understand what's going on, help us to have a framework on which to see what's going on and find ways to get along. I'm gonna go out with a song by a group. What I've seen of the music videos, it's a young, very young boys band called the Orwells, and this song is Halloween All Year. Take care and have a good one.